Welcome to Special Sauce, Serious Eats podcast about food and life. Every week on Special Sauce, we talk to some of the leading lights of American culture, food folks and non-food folks alike.
You know, I miss those moments of, you know, just being kind of by myself, just me and Price's Chicken, like you were talking about before, in a little box sitting in my car somewhere, just savoring that moment. I miss those types of pleasures.
Tommy Tomlinson is back with us. He wrote one of my favorite books of the year called The Elephant in the Room, One Fat Man's Quest to Get Smaller in a Growing America. And Tommy, now we're on the journey with you, you know, so you're at 460.
Yep.
And you realize that it's not enough to just vow to eat less. You need to dig deeper than that. And so how did you start that? What was that process like?
In writing the book, a real role model for me was a book by a guy named David Carr. He was the media critic for the New York Times for a long time.
He wrote a book about his heroin addiction.
He did. It's called The Night of the Gun. And he talked about the time in his, I guess, in his 20s when he lived in Minnesota. And he was a drug addict. And there were large portions of his life that he didn't remember anymore. And he went back and talked to the people that he hung around with then, and he, you know, treated terribly in some cases, and basically said, could you tell me about that period in my life? Tell me what I was like. You know, tell me what you thought of me, all those things. And I always admired the way, as a journalist, he went back and sort of re-reported his life. And so I did that to some extent. There were not periods in my life that I didn't remember anymore, but I emailed maybe 30 or so of my friends, people I was close to and some family members, and just sent them a few questions about, you know, my weight and, you know, stuff like, you know, do you ever think about it when I'm not around? When you're talking to other people about me, does this come up? You know, what are your kind of thoughts about my life as an overweight person? And so most of the people answered, and I learned a lot from them about, you know, how they would watch what I was eating, and they would be surprised that I would eat the same as them, but I was the one getting bigger. They didn't know that I would stop again at like the drive-thru on the way home, you know, and get like a second dinner or something. But just also learned about their concerns about me and their worry that I was going to be gone too soon, those sorts of things. And then I had longer conversations on the record that I taped with my wife, Alix Felsing, and my mom, who were two people who've been with me, you know, for most of this journey.
Yeah, Alix sounds like an amazing person. I always tell people when they ask me for advice, because I've been married 36 years now, you marry up and you hang on for dear life.
That's pretty much what I've done. And Alix has been this incredible kind of guide for me. She is, without ever nagging or hectoring or browbeating me about it, she has gently and lovingly nudged me to become a better and more healthy person.
And what's that great thing she says to you one night in bed, which I couldn't—I thought was just an amazing moment in the book?
She looked at me and said, "You made my life."
Yeah.
And that was probably the best moment I will ever have as a human being.
Yeah.
To know that I made her life. She has certainly made mine.
Sure. So in the beginning, you ask what other people think of you. And, you know, I think you start one chapter with that very notion. And that's when you really find, you know, there's two people. We are all two people. The one that we think we are and the one that other people think we are. And so what did you find?
Well, I found that, you know, they were certainly concerned about me. They certainly worried about, you know, my longevity and that sort of thing. But the other thing I realized was that there was always a distance between me and even the people I was closest to, because I never talked about my weight. It's not that other people brought it up and then I shut them down. It was just sort of a given between us that nobody ever talked about it when they were around me. And so it was the biggest secret of my life, as I said at the beginning of the book. When I wrote down those four words, I weigh 460 pounds, that's something that nobody else knew. My wife didn't know, my closest friends didn't know, my family didn't know.
And you didn't know until you stepped on the scale.
Well, that's true, too. I mean, I'd stepped on the scale as little as possible
right
before that moment. But, I mean, I certainly knew I was in that range.
Right.
But that was always a secret, and my weight and how I felt about it and how it sort of tortured me was just something I didn't talk about, even with my closest friends. And so there was always that little distance between us, because I didn't give of myself, and so I couldn't expect them to really give fully of themselves either. And so our friendships were shallower than I had hoped they would be. And so that's one thing, and I think one of the many things that I've lost or sacrificed by being so big for so long is that I don't think I ever had like the blood on blood, you know, down close in the foxhole friendships.
Yeah, you talk about your weight keeping people away. You talk about your belly literally is a physical impediment to intimacy almost.
Well, it is. I mean, certainly it's, you know, you can't, it's difficult for you to get as close to me as you can to somebody with a flat stomach. But I think in much more than that, it was sort of a psychological barrier and an emotional barrier, and that I wouldn't let people get too close, because then they would know the guilt and the shame that I felt about being so big and not being able to be in control of it. And so because I was putting up that, my wife called it the invisible wall. And because I was putting up that wall, there were just things that I never talked about with my friends and that they never talked about with me and as part of their deep feelings, because there was that distance between us.
I think the most I ever weighed was 265, but it had the same effect, by the way. I think that if you feel you're fat, you feel you're unworthy. As a result, you're really reluctant to talk about it with even your closest friends, except to joke about it in passing.
Right. I mean, and this certainly is not limited to people like me who are severely overweight. It's on the other end, too, people with anorexia or bulimia who are underweight, but they still, in their mind, they see themselves as fat.
Right.
And so they do what they do to make themselves even smaller. And so it's relational. It doesn't really matter what you weigh. It's what you feel like you weigh and what you feel like you present to the world.
If your wife calls it the invisible wall, but she still fell in love with you, you must be a charming, funny dude, man.
I'm a hell of a guy when I'm not, you know, having, you know, a rack of ribs for supper. Yeah. Well, I mean, that's part of what's has been baffling and frustrating to me and to my friends and loved ones my whole life, and that I have this other life where I'm a successful person. People like me. I've, you know, lots of fans here in Charlotte, especially, where I've been a journalist for a long time.
Right, and you had a column, so you had your picture in the paper.
Right.
You probably know my friend Kathleen Purvis.
I do, absolutely, very well. We're good friends.
She met me at Price's, finest fried
Price's
chicken in the universe.
One of my favorite all-time places, and somewhere I don't even drive by now because the temptation is so great.
For sure.
All those things where I'm a success in other parts of my life, I just had such a problem reconciling it with this person who I felt was an utter failure at trying to figure out the one big problem in my life.
Yeah.
And so that's been a mystery to me for as long as I can remember.
So it's almost like it sounds like what you embarked upon was kind of self-administered therapy without reading self-help books and without going to a therapist.
Well, I did go to a therapist a little earlier in my career, in my life. In the early 2000s, as you mentioned, I was a columnist at the Charlotte Observer, and there were a lot of sort of dark stories that I covered in a condensed time period. I covered the Virginia Tech shootings. I went to Hurricane Katrina twice. I covered an execution at the state prison here.
Oof.
Lots of really dark stuff. And it all kind of fell in on me, and I decided I needed some help. And I went to see a therapist, and she was doing what at the time, I guess it's still called, I think it's EMSR, it's electro... magnetic sensory.
Oh yeah, you write about this.
I'm botching the name. You go in and you sort of stare at a screen, and for people as old as me, it sort of looks like Pong, the old video game, where there's like little white dots going back and forth, and it's sort of, I think the idea is to sort of get you into a meditative sort of a blank state, and then you can talk about your feelings in a way that where you've cleared out a lot of other things. When I started, I thought that was the stupidest idea ever. But it turned out to actually be good and useful for me.
Yeah.
And as I talked about that other stuff going on in my life, the conversations always came back around to my weight.
Interesting.
Because I felt like almost unworthy to be doing what I was doing because I had never solved the major problem in my life.
Yeah.
And if I couldn't do that, how was I supposed to do anything else?
And yet you embarked on this even after what you would consider to be a successful bout of therapy without a therapist and without weekly meetings. You know, you didn't go the Overeaters Anonymous route or the Weight Watchers route.
I did all those things at one point or another over the years. I went to OA meetings. I went to Weight Watchers two or three different times. As I always say, your mileage may vary. You may have different experiences than I do. And whatever works for somebody, I pass no judgment on that. Those meetings always felt a little creepy to me, especially...
First of all, they're always in really depressing rooms. Have you ever noticed that?
Yes.
Have you ever seen, like, a Weight Watchers meeting in a beautiful room overlooking the mountains?
Well, the reason that doesn't happen is because at some point, everybody strips off most of their clothes for the weigh-in. You know, it's like when they weigh in at boxing matches, and they peel down their underwear because they want to make weight. You know, that was the one thing I remember about these Weight Watchers meetings was that everybody was, like, unloading all the stuff out of their pockets and taking off their shoes because that number meant everything.
Yes.
And the other thing that I have to say really pissed me off about the Weight Watchers meetings is even there, their scale was not big enough for me.
Right.
So I had to go weigh in at, like, the Y or in my doctor's office and then tell them what I weighed. And so it was like a double embarrassment that I couldn't weigh in at the weigh-in.
Yeah.
Which was like the focal point of that meeting. And so I just never felt comfortable there.
Yeah.
And so I've had experience with all those things, and I certainly took in and absorbed, I think, the good parts of them. I mean, certainly the diet plan I'm on, even though I sort of just came up with it, is basically what Weight Watchers does.
Sure.
They just, you know, put a numerical value on stuff instead of calories. But I'm doing it without the meetings.
You know, even your attempts to reach out to people, in a way, that's related to what they do at AA, right?
Yes.
You talk to all the people that you've heard or that, you know, have negatively been affected by your addiction. So,
yeah, if you look at it in that way, I mean, she would probably cringe to hear this, but my wife has been my sponsor for quite a long time.
Right, right. So you embark on this, and it's not a straight line, right? I mean, what are the impediments that you noticed?
Well, there are lots of them. I mean, the first ones for me are obviously just, you know, I had some success right away. And then, you know, in the book, I show you what my life was like over the course of a year. So I had a couple of pretty good months, and then my wife and I just have all these little traditions that we do, just little things to, like, you know, like little date nights that we enjoy having. And one of them in our past was always on March 14th or 15th, now I forget which one, it was Pi Day, because that's Pi, the number 3.14 or whatever. And that's just sort of become this little hokey, nerdy thing that we do. We would always go get Pi on Pi Day. And so we did. Even though I had been doing pretty well weight-wise and keeping track of calories, we went to this little diner that we both love and where the servings are enormous. I ordered banana cream pie, not knowing what it would look like. I don't think I'd ever gotten it there before. And the serving came, it was massive. And I cut into the pie and I hit something solid. And I sort of cut all the way through and I realized the slice was so big. There was an entire banana underneath the whipped cream.
That's so great.
You know?
Yeah, you write about that in the book. It's awesome.
It's like, holy shit. And of course, the pie was incredibly good. And so those little moments where you try to preserve some little tradition or some little moment that you've gotten a lot of pleasure out of in the past, you know, you run into, well, does that mean I have to eat a whole big piece of banana cream pie? That night, I did, and I shouldn't have. And so that's one of those things that sort of knocks you backwards.
Yeah.
And then all the other just normal things in life, like one thing that happened the year that I chronicle in the book is our dog died. You know, a dog that we had, my wife and I, had become really attached to, who's 14 years old. At one point during the spring and summer, it starts to become pretty clear that he's really ill. And then he dies in the fall. And that was, you know, a major blow to us, and the kind
of
thing
that's like for you, that's like your child dying.
Almost, yeah. And so it's one of those things that in the past certainly would have knocked me over the edge, and I would have binged on food. And I was able to, that month, I'm sure I didn't do well. I have to go back and look at the book and remember now. But it was a roller coaster. So there would be some months when I would just feel like I've got this thing licked. And I would be doing great. And then something would happen, or I'd fall off the wagon a little bit, or I'd eat something I shouldn't, or something, you know, it could be as simple as my wife and I could have a little spat or something, and I would feel bad about it. And that would send me on to 2 or 3 days of eating poorly.
Yeah.
And so it was, you know, you're right. It's never a straight line. And if you expect for it to be a straight line, you are doomed to fail.
Yes, that exacerbates the problem. I mean, Thanksgiving is always a bitch.
Yes.
For everyone, but particularly if you're really determined to lose weight. And so for me, I always devise strategies.
Right. I don't do, you know, a lot of people diet and they have these cheat days where they, you know, once a week they eat whatever
right.
they want. I don't really do that, but I do consider sort of Thanksgiving like a free space on the bingo card. You know, I don't indulge the way I used to, certainly. But I do give myself a chance to taste, you know, if the cousins made some mac and cheese as their traditional thing, I'll try that. But I will say it is a good excuse also to, like, I'm going to go watch the football game now, you know. And so I get up from the table. I push myself away. And I don't take, you know, a plate of food with me to the living room to watch the football game. I just take, like, a glass of water or something.
Right.
I'm able to feel like I enjoyed the moment. I've had fellowship with my family. I'm, you know, doing something everybody else is doing, but I'm not having that, like, third helping of turkey and dressing
right.
or whatever.
And you list all the things that make you eat, and you talk about why does death and mourning just produce a veritable ocean of food? Did you have to deal with them one at a time, all the triggers for your binging?
Well, some of them happen simultaneously, you know, like, say I have an argument with my wife and that was brought on because I got bad news at work that day. Or, you know, I had a difficult phone call on a story I was working on and I got home and the dog was sick. You know, so there are things that can, you know, tip you one way or the other. And you never know when those things are coming. Well, I guess some of them you do. You can sort of anticipate
right.
some things, but a lot of them are, you get blindsided. And so I consider, you know, I think about the day-to-day battle with this the way I think about baseball. You know, baseball is a long season. It's 162 games. Nobody wins every game. And if you win a good bit more than you lose, if you win 2/3 of your games, you're considered to have a really successful season. If I get through 2/3 of my days and I've eaten right, eaten really clean, been healthy, exercised, done well, and I'm showing, you know, week to week, month to month progress, I'm going to take that.
Yeah.
Because I know it's a long, long season. And I know that if I put the pressure on myself to do it perfectly every single day, then when I do backslide or when I do fail, it's worse. It's way worse. And it leads me into worse areas where if I just think, yesterday kind of sucked, it was a bad day, but we'll start again tomorrow. We'll start again today and
right.
do it right. That's a much easier lifestyle for me to manage.
Yeah. You were a sports writer, right, for many years for ESPN and a sports website. And you wrote this incredible piece about Jared Lorenzen, who was a New York Giant for a little while, and he was a 300-pound quarterback. And apparently, according to you, when you did your story, he got up to 400 pounds. Was it weird being around such fanatically fit people most of the time and being as big as you were?
You know, it's so funny. Several people have asked me that. And the answer is, the athletes are really fit, but the sports writers aren't. You know, and so when you go into
it's true. What's that guy, Jason Whitlock or whatever his name is? He's not fit.
No, and Jason and I used to work together many years ago and at the Charlotte Observer, and we're two of the large Americans in the sports writing world. But if you know, if you ever went through a locker room in a typical, you know, baseball, basketball, football team, you'll see these incredibly fit athletes. But if you ever hang out in the press box, you'll see a bunch of pasty white guys like me, you know. And so it wasn't, you know, it wasn't weird to be doing that because I saw a lot of people like me, you know, around, unfortunately. Press boxes, by the way, are awful for people who are trying to stay healthy because there's a ton of free food.
Right. And it's not even very good, but it's free. It's there.
And some places it's really good and some places not. But it's always, at the very least, it's like hot dogs and potato chips and chocolate chip cookies.
Right.
You know, that's the baseline.
Right.
And so it's really hard to, like, stay, have any kind of health when you do that. And when it's, you can have as much as you want.
You've described it as a lifelong activity. It's not even an activity. It's just a way you're going to try to live. Do you wish that there was an end point?
I think of, there's this great book called Olive Kittredge by Elizabeth Stroud.
It's that Fran McDormand made into a miniseries.
Yeah, it was a miniseries, yeah. And I haven't seen the miniseries, but toward the end of the book, you know, Olive has gone through all these travails and she's brought some on other people as well. She says, you know, life is baffling to me, but I don't want to leave it. And that's the kind of the way I feel, that especially when I'm trying to figure out why I got so big and how to deal with this every day, it's baffling and mystifying and often frustrating. But I love just being in the world so much every day that I don't want to leave it. And I know, you know, to get to your question, I know that if I tried to lose all this weight very quickly, that the odds are that I would yo-yo and go back the other way. My doctor likes to say that 91% of the people who lose weight on any kind of crash diet or anything like that gain all the weight back and then some.
Yeah.
And he's told me that my job for the rest of my life is to stay in the 9%.
Yeah.
And so that's what I'm trying to do. And I know that the other ways have not worked for me.
Yeah.
So, yeah, it is a daunting task to think about. This is something I'm probably going to have to pay attention to the rest of my life. But what's the alternative? You know, not having much of a life.
Yeah.
And so I've decided that's the lesser of the evils.
Do you think this mindfulness, which I think is really what you're talking about, has affected your creative output? Does it change the way you write?
I have always thought that one of my strengths as a writer was empathy, that I could talk to somebody else and sort of feel like what it's like to be them. And
could you talk to our president, please?
Give me 30 minutes. I'll just change his life.
Okay, thank you.
And I felt like one of the reasons for that was that I longed for that from other people. You know, I think I've chosen my friends partly on people who aren't judgmental,
mm-hmm.
you know, people who don't look at other people and see their flaws, but they see their strengths or see what their possibilities. I think it's likely that in going through all this, that I have gained some more empathy and more compassion for people who struggle with whatever it is that they struggle with. you know, the struggles of people who are dealing with alcohol or drugs or gambling or whatever, the patterns are very, very similar. And their lives, you know, erupt in different ways. And not just that, but just ordinary life. I'll tell you one of the things that really gave me a perspective on all this. When I was a newspaper columnist, if people would call in, this was before email was quite so prevalent, I used to get a lot of calls every day from people who mostly didn't like something I wrote. Fewer people call to say they do like something. And the people who would just blast me the worst over the phone, over voicemail, every once in a while they'd leave their phone number. And when they did, I always called them back. And 99% of the time I called them back, they would say hello. I'd say, this is Tommy from the newspaper. And they would always go, oh, man, I am so sorry.
like someone had died.
Well, it was like, you know, they would always say, the kids were giving me grief. My car wouldn't start. I hate my job. It's cold outside. I was so angry. And then I read your column, and you made me angry, too. And you were the thing I could vent. You know, I can't scream at my kids, but I can scream at you.
Wow.
And so I realized that, and this was advice, I mean, or a perspective I really wish I'd had when I was younger, that when somebody is calling you a fat ass, or somebody is, you know, making fun of you or about your weight or whatever it is in your life, that it's almost never about you. It's almost always about something has gone bad or there's something rotten in their lives. And that's why they're taking it out on you. You're a handy target. And so once I had a better understanding of that, that really changed the way that I processed, you know, when other people were saying bad things to me. And I hope in doing this book, I've remembered that well, and I'm not quite so quick to anger or judgment.
Yeah, that's so interesting. I can tell you, Tommy, that one thing you should never do if you struggle with weight like I do is start a food website. That's part of what my memoir is about, is I don't spend much time dwelling on it. But, you know, if you find yourself surrounded by just seriously delicious food day in and day out, and people always want you to opine on the food, it's really hard, dude. That's all I can tell you. So no matter how much money they offer you, if I offered you, because I wouldn't mind you being the editor-in-chief of Serious Eats, don't take the gig, dude.
And I'm preemptively turning you down. You know, food is, in many ways, the last acceptable vice we have. You know, you get looked down on if you smoke too much or if you drink too much. And food carries with it all that symbolic power of being celebration and fun and enjoyment and a craft, a skill. A good cook is a great skill. And so that's why there are all these food channels and cooking channels. There are no drinking channels, you know. There are no gambling channels or shoplifting channels or whatever. Food is still seen as something that it's okay to overindulge in.
Right.
And it is. For many, many people.
Yeah,
but
sure.
Not for those of us who struggle with it.
Your new life, has it taken away any of the joy that you derive from eating?
I don't know if it's taken away any of the joy of eating itself, because I still eat delicious stuff. I just don't eat as much of it. And I've given up certain things. The one thing that I feel like I have lost is the joy in certain moments.
The joy of certain moments.
So, for example, I've been on the road a lot doing a book tour the last few weeks. And I used to be on the road quite a bit as a writer. And there was nothing better for me, and this is going to sound pathetic, but it's the truth, than finishing like a hard day of work on the road, going back to my hotel, stopping at Wendy's or McDonald's or somewhere on the way, getting a big juicy burger, getting back to my hotel room and sitting there in my underwear watching a ball game on TV.
Oh, I can relate. I can relate, dude.
Yeah. And so that pleasure, that moment of just that, I put in a hard day of work and by God, now I'm going to reward myself. That I don't do that anymore.
Yeah.
And so that little pleasure of that moment, I don't indulge in. And I miss that.
Yeah.
You know, I miss those moments of, you know, just being kind of by myself, just me and Price's chicken, like you were talking about before, in a little box sitting in my car somewhere, just savoring that moment.
Yeah. Now,
there are obvious consequences of that, which is why I don't do it anymore, but I miss those types of pleasures.
Yeah. You know, I'm the same way, because when I would go, even when I would go on assignment or travel to eat, or, you know, I used to write about music like you too, I think.
I did, yeah.
My back seat of my car rental would be filled with enough styrofoam to kill the planet. You know, because I couldn't go two blocks without, oh man, is that daiquiri any good? Oh, what? It says it's the best fried chicken in town. It must be the best fried chicken in town. And when you're on the road by yourself, right, there are no governors in place, right? You don't have your wife to say, what the hell did you just bring home? So I could totally relate to that sort of feeling of emancipation or freedom and having to nip that in the bud, because I'm the same way. Now I just don't do it. I think if I get one styrofoam box full of food, I'm going to end up with 20. I just don't go there.
Right. And that's and then the other thing you mentioned, like when you're on the road, every time I used to go to a new city, I would spend hours beforehand looking up like the best restaurants in the city and certainly the best ones near where I was going to be staying. And the problem is that when you look them up and you see like five good ones, you want to try all five of them.
Right.
And so I would do that.
And I do.
2 days, right?
Yeah.
And so I've learned to, you know, manage those things a lot better, and knowing that if I go somewhere, I'll find something good to eat at some point. I just don't need to worry about getting like the five best things all at once.
Yeah, it's so true. Towards the end of the book, you wrote this beautiful, beautiful paragraph. You say, I'm still a fat man. I will probably always be one in my head, even if I shed every pound I want to lose. But I know for sure now that there is another man inside me, and I'm no longer scared to meet him. A beautiful ending, because it's not a artificially happy ending.
You know, by the end of the book, I've lost some weight. I've tried to be coy about how much because I want people to read it and find out. But I certainly haven't lost all the weight I want or need to lose. I'm still a big guy.
But you're still going in the right direction.
I'm still going in the right direction, but I'm still a large human being.
Yeah.
And, this whole thing is just a long process. And I suspect in the same way that people who haven't drunk for 20 years still consider themselves alcoholics, you know, if I get down to the weight I want to be, in my head I'll still be a fat guy. And I'll still
right.
have to look out for, you know, the little traps and danger areas that I look for now.
It's true. They're like third rails in our lives, aren't they, when you enjoy food as much as we do?
3 years ago for Lent, I gave up fast food. And so I haven't had McDonald's, Burger King, Wendy's, KFC, Taco Bell, any of that stuff in almost 3 years now. But I know 30 years from now, I'm still going to drive by that damn Burger King and it's going to smell incredible. And some little part of me is going to want to pull in there. And so those are all temptations that I'm sure I'll spend the rest of my life trying to and hoping to avoid.
Well, the Pope would be really happy about your giving up fast food for Lent, right?
The Pope? I didn't know. Has he spoken out about fast food?
He should. He's got a lot of things on his plate, no pun intended. but now it's time for the special sauce all-you-can-answer buffet.
All right.
It's really a word buffet, so we don't have to worry, right? Because you and I don't fare well at buffets.
Exactly right. We fare a little too well.
We fare a little too well. So Who's at your last supper? No family allowed. Can be living, dead, poets, artists, musicians, politicians.
All right. I'd like Prince for sure.
Prince?
Yeah.
Anil Dash, who runs a software company called Glitch, is the world's biggest Prince fan, has written beautifully about Prince.
I've read some of his work on Prince.
He's a genius. I love Anil. His wife was the first Sirius East general manager and stayed with me for 6 or 7 years of the insane joyride that Sirius East was, that you'll read about in my book. But anyway, all right, so Prince is a great start. That's awesome. Keep going.
I'm a music guy. I would also want Aretha Franklin.
How could you not want Aretha Franklin? Did you see Amazing Grace? It was very weird because it was really wonderful, but I was profoundly uncomfortable watching it because she seemed so unhappy.
Really?
Yeah. Like, I think it has to do with whatever went down with her father, or there was just a weird thing. Like, there was so much joy on that album, but it's not, and there's joy surrounding her, but she does not seem full of joy when she's singing these songs. Anyway, I love this. Aretha and Prince is a great start. You got two more people.
Sure. One of them was I have very few sports heroes, but Hank Aaron was one of my sports heroes.
I love this.
Growing up in Georgia, following the Braves.
Okay.
And then the fourth person is somebody whose name I do not know. But when I was growing up on the beach in St. Simons Island, Georgia, there was a guy who was a beach bum, basically, who lived in like New Zealand half the year and did construction work. And then he came and lived on the beach in Georgia for 6 months out of the year, did nothing except just sit on the beach and watch the girls and hang out all day. And I always thought I wanted that guy's life. And so I would like to talk to him to figure out how he pulled that off.
Dinner guest.
Yes, the unnamed dinner guest, but he knows who he is. If I have the power to bring back Prince from the dead, I can certainly track down that guy.
So what are you eating at the Last Supper?
Oh, man. Well, if it's the Last Supper, for real, and I'm gone after it's over, I would have what we had almost every Saturday night and many other nights when I was growing up. And that would be fried catfish straight out of the river.
Made in bacon fat.
Fried in that cornmeal and bacon grease that had been in the river 2 hours before. French fries, hand-cut French fries that my dad used to make. Coleslaw, hush puppies, and sweet tea, and probably a banana pudding to top
for dessert. Wow.
And then I would go directly into a coma, and that would be pretty easy to knock
exactly.
off.
Exactly. And you don't have to worry, like, because it's your Last Supper, the elephant's no longer in the room.
Exactly. I'll have the whole bowl of banana pudding.
Yeah, and it can have whole bananas in it, and
exactly.
You won't feel guilty.
Perfect.
So what's in your fridge now? And in your case, it's a particularly resonant and relevant question because I imagine what is in your fridge now may be different than what was in your fridge before you started to come to grips with your problem.
Yeah, there used to be a lot of takeout stuff, pizza boxes and that sort of thing in the fridge. Now there's almost always a rotisserie chicken in there from our local grocery store. There is always, always, always broccoli in the fridge, because that is our secret weapon. After one of my book signings early on, somebody came up to Alex, my wife, and said that she ought to write a cookbook because she's helped me lose all this weight. And what she thought and what I thought was that cookbook would be 90% broccoli. You know, because we
and it could be called The Elephant Is No Longer in the Room.
Pretty good. I'll have to throw that out, if she's willing. So lots of broccoli and salad greens and
yeah.
That sort of stuff.
Got it.
There is always going to be some good cheese in there because my wife grew up in Wisconsin.
Sure.
And she likes the good stuff. And then there will be a pitcher of sweet tea that is not nearly as sweet as it used to be.
Got it. So it'll be slightly sweetened.
Yes, slightly sweetened. It used to be, you know, you could pour a glass and it could stand up on its own. And I have slowly over the years tapered off the amount of sugar in there, where it still has enough sweetness to me to be tasty, but not nearly as sweet as what you would get at, you know, your normal Southern diner.
So what's the most influential book you've ever read as a writer and as a human being?
The most influential book was my favorite book as a kid. It's sort of an obscure book. It was called The Mad Scientist Club. It was written by this guy named Bertrand R. Brimley. And I read it as part of the Scholastic Book Club, which is this thing they used to have for kids. I think they might still have it, where they had a little catalog of books. That you could, this was pre-Amazon, and you would order books from this little catalog. I read this book so many times that the binding fell apart, and I had to buy like four or five copies. In fact, I still have a copy now. I'm 55 years old. It was a book of short stories about these kids who sort of brought chaos to their small town by doing all these weird science experiments. And what it told me was that smart kids could be cool too, and that they could have fun too, because they were always like getting one over on the jocks and the bullies and all those people. And it made me realize that you could have a fun, interesting, rewarding, pleasurable life and not be one of the cool kids.
That's so interesting.
And that's something I've taken with me my whole life.
That's so fascinating. So who would you love to have a one-on-one lunch with just to see how he or she thinks?
I would love to have lunch with Guy Fieri for this reason, because he has done, I think, an incredible thing. He has brought, you know, sort of the small-town diner, the place that in many towns is probably often struggling, or the ethnic food of some sort, and he has lifted it up around the country.
It's true.
In a way that, you know, I care about much more than I care about who got the Michelin stars this year. You know?
Right, yeah. Me too. You do know that some of us have been doing this longer than Guy Fieri. He just has a platform, and you are right in that he has made a difference in more people's lives than probably anyone else.
Yeah, and before them, I really followed Jane and Michael Stern.
They inspired me as well.
Right. And so I think the other part that makes him really interesting to me is that he's caught so much heat for doing this, you know, that people see him as a phony. I think a lot of people who are kind of hipster, cool, think, you know, he's with his frosted hair and his tattoos or whatever, that he's somehow inauthentic. And that may be right. I know he's opened a couple of restaurants that people thought were really terrible and got that famous trashed review in the New York Times for his place in Times Square. But I just want to know sort of where his heart is, I guess. He obviously made a lot of money off this gimmick he figured out in a way that I think even maybe the Sterns didn't. You know, he became a TV star.
Yeah.
And so you see him at the Super Bowl and places like that. And so he's caught all this blowback from it. And I'm really interested in just sort of how he sees what he does and how people perceive him.
Yeah. All right. It's just been declared Tommy Tomlinson Day all over the world.
Finally.
What's happening on that day?
Ooh. Well, everybody gets to sleep a little later than usual.
Okay.
Because I've still not, even in my advanced middle age, have not gotten my body clock to wake up at dawn every morning like I'd like it for it to do. So you sleep as long as you want. And then there's, it's a beautiful day. It's like 75 degrees outside. So you have lots of options. You can do stuff outdoors. You can do stuff indoors. Mainly what I would want people to do was spend as much time as possible with the people they care about. You know, I feel like our lives are almost designed these days to pull apart the sort of family bonds that we have. They're not just families, but friends too.
Mm-hmm.
Everybody's working. We don't all have 9-to-5 jobs like we used to. And so we're not all in the same schedules anymore. I know when I try to get together with friends or family, just working out logistics of that is incredibly difficult most days. And so I would just love a day where nobody had any appointments.
Yeah.
And you can go hang out with your friends.
Yeah, that's awesome.
Basically all I would want out of that day.
Yeah. And look, what are good friends? They're someone once said they're the ones you choose. You know, you don't choose your family, but you do choose your friends.
Absolutely.
And so, wow, Tommy, this has been awesome. I don't even know how to thank you enough for sharing your special sauce with
us. Well, don't send me any food.
I'm not sending you any food, and I'm never offering you the job of veteran-chief at SiriusEats.com.
I've never been happier to turn down the job.
Go to TommyTomlinson.com to read some of his extraordinary stories. Check out his podcast, Southbound. And whatever you do, read The Elephant in the Room, One Man's Quest to Get Smaller in a Growing America. Thank you very much, Tommy Tomlinson. It's really been a pleasure.
Thanks, Ed. This was a joy to do.
And we'll see you next time, Serious Eaters.